seated. The next case for oral argument is Donald Charlson, appellant, versus Angela Charlson, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Sabers, an attorney from Rapid City. And we have, for the appellee, Ms. Linda Lee Viken, an attorney from Rapid City, and Ms. Shelley Rohr, an attorney from St. Paul, Minnesota. I understand, Ms. Viken, you'll be presenting this morning. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. All right, Mr. Sabers, you have 20 minutes, sir, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Justice. Justices of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Gilbertson, counsel, clients and clients' friends. At some point, I expect I'm going to sleep before I give these arguments before this court, but that day has not come. I was told by a wise trial lawyer I was trying a case against 10 or so years ago, and something that rings in my ears, that if you sleep the night before trial, or if you sleep the night before you argue before the Supreme Court, you need to hang up the cleats and be done. And so the carpeting is considerably thinner in my motel room this morning than it was last night. Having said that, this case is somewhat unique in that it started as a divorce, but it ended up as a contract interpretation dispute. The parties were married in 1993. The premarital contract was written by a South Dakota lawyer, South Dakota law. The party signed it the day before they were married in Deadwood, South Dakota, and they were married for over 20 years. The premarital agreement in this case has two purposes. The court need look no further than the purposes in agreement, or purposes of intent, paragraph in the very first page of the premarital agreement. It says there's really two purposes, and honestly, this isn't all that uncommon in a premarital agreement. They all kind of look like this. They talk about the rights of parties in property that exists at the time of the marriage. Okay? That's always the first purpose. People want to protect their separate property that exists when you get married. The second purpose, which is equally important because it is also found in the purpose and intent paragraph, is to define the rights of the parties in the property they're going to acquire during, in this case, a 20-year marriage. And as expected, the premarital agreement addresses both. Now, the parties don't agree on much in this case, and it almost immediately diverges. If you look at page 24 of the appellee brief, on page 24 of the appellee brief, this sentences exist. It says, there is no evidence or testimony that either party intended on acquiring marital property when entering into the premarital agreement, nor that they were required to acquire any marital property. The PMA language is void of any language regarding any such intent. My client respectfully submits that there could be nothing more wrong than that sentence. Marital property is defined explicitly in the premarital agreement. Premarital agreement paragraph 4 says, marital property shall be, and it shouldn't be lost on anybody that the word shall is used. Shall is not may. Shall is not could be. It says, shall be all property acquired from and after the date of marriage. But it says more than that. The second sentence says, marital property that you cannot relinquish. The second sentence of paragraph 7 says, you can relinquish or waive your rights to separate property, but you can't waive or relinquish your rights to marital property. That's significant. And if there was any dispute, the last sentence of paragraph 4 clearly and undeniably says this, and I've read this agreement more than once. It says that marital property acquired from and after the date of marriage regardless of title or ownership, shall remain marital property.
Okay, but so then how do you resolve what you just said with the very first phrase of paragraph 4, which says, except as specifically provided above, and above is 5-6 paragraphs on separate property.
Yep, it says separate property that exists as of the date of this agreement. So as of the date of the agreement, if you look at Exhibit A, you see Ms. Charlson's premarital property. For all intents and purposes, she had 3 restaurants and an investment account. Okay, that's what existed as of the date of the agreement. I believe that the interpretation this court should adopt gives credence to the commingling and separate property paragraph, because I believe that the contract also specifically says that the parties are going to. They are going to put separate, this is paragraph 7, they are going to put separate property and earnings during the marriage into a joint marital bank account. And a joint marital bank account is a joint marital bank account. I don't know how you read it any other way. But once it goes into the joint marital bank account, there are only 2 purposes of that account that you could ever find. The first purpose, as one would expect, is, listen, these people have to pay their bills. So you're paying marital expenses, taxes, utilities, house payments, car payments, car insurance. That's one purpose. The other purpose, the only other stated purpose of the joint marital bank account, is to acquire any acquisition of marital property during the time period of the marriage. So I believe that the commingling paragraph, the separate property paragraph, can absolutely be reconciled with that, because I don't think it's commingling. The parties anticipated. They thought about it. They contracted for the fact that they're going to take their separate property, or they're going to take their earnings. Both of them had earnings throughout the marriage. They're going to put them into an account. That's how they're going to live. Married couple acquire marital property. And the reason why that is different than commingling is because it was contracted for by the parties. In other words, they knew. Parties were supposed to use their best efforts not to commingle. What I'm saying is it's not commingling when you contract for an obligation to put your separate property and your marital earnings into a joint marital bank account that only has 2 purposes. So there is evidence in this that the parties intended to acquire marital property. But honestly, that's just reasonable too. They were married for 20 years. So that's how you go about reconciling those two. We believe that once you make the decision, now Ms. Charlson had 9 accounts during the 9 separate accounts at the time of the marriage. But once a decision was made to put separate property or earnings into the joint marital bank account that only has 2 purposes, it is our position that the rights to separate property were extinguished. And why is that? Because marital property is defined as any property acquired from and after the date of marriage. Then the second paragraph of paragraph 4 says, although you can relinquish rights to separate property, you can never relinquish rights to marital property. It's because the contract contemplated then putting separate property into a joint marital bank account to acquire marital property. And then if there's any dispute remaining, marital property shall remain marital property regardless of title or ownership. That's how it's reconciled. And quite honestly, that's how these parties lived throughout their marriage. They both put money into the joint marital bank account, and I believe it's undisputed that the joint marital bank account was used to acquire significant marital assets during the course of the marriage. Now,
But then, how do you reconcile the language? I don't have the paragraph number here, but where the parties contemplated a failure to segregate property, and they said, if they do, even if they fail to do it, it shall not be construed to change the character.
Because I believe that is what occurs when Ms. Charlson takes one of her 9 separate accounts and invests her money into a marital asset. To give you an example, in this case, the parties acquired Sioux Falls Massage Envy. Mr. Charlson and three of his friends at some point decided to fund the startup. This is an example to tell you why our interpretation makes sense. So Sioux Falls Massage Envy was started by Mr. Charlson and three of his friends. At that time, the joint marital bank account had plus or minus $220,000 in it. No discussion was had between the parties that wouldn't be a marital asset. So what do? They fund it. This was started largely because Don Charlson, my client's daughter, was going to run Sioux Falls Massage Envy. So they funded out of the joint marital bank account. Let's say 6 months down the line, Sioux Falls Massage Envy has a cash shortage, and they don't have marital funds necessary to fund a marital account. Ms. Charlson says, I have Taco John's Belle Fouche. I got $30,000 in my operating account. I'll put that separate funds into our marital asset. That's commingling. And she did that on occasion. But that's commingling because you can't get a...
Stop right there because it doesn't just say commingling. It says failure to segregate.
And what I'm saying is that is different. Failure to segregate. That is different than a conscious contractual decision. They were obligated to put their separate property into a joint marital bank account. And you can only acquire marital property as it's defined in the contract once you put your separate property into that account. And so if you can only buy marital property and then you go back to the very strong definition of marital property, we believe that is different. Or, quite honestly, try to reconcile the two. Because marital property is all property acquired from and after the date of marriage, regardless of title and ownership. And it says you can never waive any interest in marital property, but you can. And that's important. The second paragraph, the second sentence of paragraph 4 defining marital property says you can waive a claim in separate property. You can relinquish a claim in separate property. And I believe that sentence was written because the parties contemplated putting their separate property during the marriage into a joint marital bank account to acquire marital property. Now, the difficulties in the application, and I'm going to read two findings and one conclusion of law. Finding a fact by the trial court that was proposed by Ms. Charlson, the first one was plaintiff's separate funds were in part funding the ordinary living expenses in addition to purchasing assets that have marital value and separate value. Paragraph 7 doesn't say, you know, this case could have been resolved very quickly and easily.
Before I get confused, yep. You just read what you said was a proposed finding. Was it a finding that the court adopted?
It was a finding that the court adopted, yes. It was finding of fact number 157.
So it's not a proposed finding. It's an actual finding by Judge Day.
It was.
Okay.
So that have marital value and separate value. Well, they have to add the term and separate value, Justice Sinner, because if you read paragraph 7, it says any acquisition of marital property. And any is not a term of restriction. It's not a term of limitation. And if they wanted to maintain a separate property interest, how difficult would it have been for Ms. Charlson's attorney who drafted this to say, to acquire any marital property that may continue to have a separate property interest in it? Because that would have given notice to the parties who signed this that when they take their earnings during the marriage and their separate property and they put it into what's called a joint marital bank account to acquire marital property, oh, that by the way, 20 years later, it's not going to be marital property. Because if you look at what happened, and I'll get to this, and I got to hurry. If you look, their expert was asked, so Mr. Charlson's funds, this is page 1269 of the transcript. So Mr. Charlson's funds go to pay the living expenses, while Ms. Charlson's funds go to create a separate property interest in his Edward Jones partnership under your methodology? Yes. So my client's putting the entirety of his substantial income into a joint marital bank account. She's putting money in for the same purpose, her earnings or her separate property to acquire marital property and apply ordinary. But they're creating a distinction there. They're saying, wait a minute, she wasn't obligated to pay the ordinary living expenses. She was only acquiring her own separate property. That's not an interpretation that's reasonable. That's not an interpretation consistent with the way they live their lives. They call the joint marital bank account a pass-through account. the trial court did as well, finding of fact number 127. They keep calling it a pass-through account. If it was a pass-through account, the attorney who drafted it should have called it a pass-through account and not a joint marital bank account. Because when any person reads joint marital bank account, the first case we talked about the interpretation and whether reasonable people could, I believe reasonable people could never agree that a joint marital bank account is a joint marital bank account. Because why wouldn't you call it a pass-through account if that's what they wanted it to be? Then conclusion of law number 23 that we're asking that this court reverse when it does the interpretation. Paragraph 7 of the PMA does not say that all property purchased with funds from the joint property is marital property. Rather, it provides the account may be used to acquire what the parties want to be marital. Any contract that is supposed to define the rights of the parties, but it relies on what the parties are going to want once a divorce has been filed, that cannot be an interpretation adopted by this court. I have done divorce work and litigation work to know long enough that what a party wants in a divorce could be very different than what the rights were that were defined at the time you sign a contract. Tell you what, a lot of people want a lot of different things once they know that they're in a divorce work. The next point is the experts. I'll acknowledge that in most cases, when you look at whether a trial court should have adopted the report or the opinions of an expert, it's an abuse of discretion standard. But I think this court has to take an incredibly close look at what happened in this case. The trial court adopted the interpretation of Ms. Charlson's experts. It didn't adopt her interpretation. It did not adopt her understanding. And because I like to be able to quote exactly why it's not me arguing this, it's them. The Appley brief at page 20 specifically says, the expert's interpretation is, quote, not based on Angela's interpretation of the PMA. That's absolutely right. She hired an expert who had a different interpretation than the party who signed the contract. If in litigation I get to go hire an expert who's going to disagree with my client, that is a Pandora's box that I have never seen before, because if you look at every contract case, there's a couple of contract cases you've written, Justice Zinner, that really emphasize this. The parties. It's what the parties thought. It's what the parties agreed to, not their experts 20 years later in divorce litigation. They admit the expert's interpretation is not based on Ms. Charlson's interpretation. Furthermore, finding of fact number...
We don't look to what the parties necessarily interpret agreements to be. We look at what the agreement says if it's not ambiguous.
That's right. Ms. Charlson testified that she had no idea how she would go about tracing her separate funds through a joint marital bank account. She could not give an explanation. She was asked repeatedly, I have no idea, I have no clue. The only person who could explain it, who gave that interpretation, was her experts. And because if you look at finding of fact number 39, Justice Everson, it says VCG, that's her experts. Their tracing, this is a quote, VCG's tracing contradicted plaintiff's intent regarding her separate property with her separate funds. So now we know their experts disagreed with her interpretation and how they lived their lives. Because honestly, if you look at this case and you read the transcripts, I would tell you, Don and Angela, honestly, the parties who signed it, they're not that far apart on what they were doing. There were no loans. We never had any writing on any loans. We never had any writing on any indebtedness. We put money in the joint account. The only people, so we have two admissions in this record. The experts didn't agree with the party who signed the contract, their client, Ms. Charlson's interpretation. Their experts didn't agree with her understanding. Since when in South Dakota do you get to go hire experts who disagree with your client, disagree with your client's interpretation, and rewrite the contract better than Ms. Charlson wrote for herself? We will live with the terms of the contract my client signed. In this case, they keep saying they don't like the terms of the contract. We like the terms of the contract just fine. But you have to reconcile the fact that the parties were making a conscious decision to affect and give effect to the two purposes of this premarital agreement: protected property that existed as of the date of the agreement, and to acquire marital property with a broad definition that you can waive claims to separate property, but you can never waive claims to marital property. And when you use the word shall be marital property. Those are words of significance in contracts. The last one, and this is footnote 9 in the Appellee's brief, page 33. What Angela thought she was doing is not the same as what the contract actually does. So, Justice Severson, to address your question again, what Angela thought she was doing is not as what the contract actually does. The only people who say that are her experts. Because Angela testified to what her understanding of the contract was, what her interpretation of the contract was, and that is different. So, when to come back to my question, I've got 30 seconds left. When Judge Day adopted the interpretation that he did, that wasn't Ms. Charlson's interpretation or understanding. It was the understanding and interpretation of her experts. They didn't sign the contract. The party signed the contract. And there is no South Dakota law, I guarantee it, and I have looked and looked, that would ever say that you look to some third party's understanding of a contract or interpretation of a contract, and it trumps your own client. My time is up. I will see the court back in 20 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sabers. Ms. Viking, you have 20 minutes.
Justice Gilbertson, members of the court, counsel, may it please the court. I think it's important to start with some general principles that have to be applied in this case. First of all, this court has recognized that the main reason for a prenuptial agreement is to take away the discretion of the trial court in dividing property at the time of the divorce. That's Walker versus Walker. This court has also made clear in its rulings that a valid prenuptial agreement is to be enforced. It's also important in this case to recognize that while the conclusions of law are fully reviewable, the findings of fact must be clearly erroneous. And Mr. Charlson has not directed the court to any specific finding that he believes erroneous, or has he pointed to any specific provision he says is ambiguous. In fact, I hear his testimony say he does not think it's ambiguous. And of course, the trial court judges the credibility of the witnesses. And Judge Day spent 10 days in court with these folks. And maybe it's noteworthy that in the initial validity hearing in this case, he found Mr. Charlson not to be credible when Mr. Charlson said, well, I didn't have an attorney, or I didn't understand this. It's the same kind of self-serving statements that he's made in the final case on interpretation. Since a pre-marriage agreement is a contract, then we have to look at contract laws and how they apply. And one contract law is that we look at the four corners of the document. We don't pick and choose one little thing and then not explain how it fits into the entire picture. And that's where Mr. Charlson's arguments really fail in this case. He focuses primarily on two provisions. One is paragraph four and paragraph seven. He ignores or minimizes all of the other applicable provisions, including part two on separate separate property, paragraph five, paragraph nine, the commingling paragraphs. And also remember that paragraph nine says no statement or act of either party can amend or modify this agreement.
Counsel, is this an unusual provision?
Excuse me?
Is this an unusual provision in a premarital agreement?
The commingling?
Well, this reference to oral statements and how they should be handled.
No. No, it is not, Your Honor. In fact, nothing is particularly different here except perhaps the loan concept, which counsel has not given us an explanation for, and which Justice Zinter pointed out has a role in this case. And so I think that in these issues, let me just quickly cover a couple of the more minor issues, one being the expert. The expert is, of course, to aid the court in making a decision. And this court has held that when it comes to evidentiary rulings, such as admitting the expert report, that this court does not substitute its own judgment for the trial court, but rather reviews whether a judicial mind, in view of the law and the circumstances, would have reasonably reached the same conclusion, State versus Bingham. Mr. Charlson's primary argument is based on the testimony of Ms. Charlson related to marital loans. There's no argument about the qualifications. There's no argument about the methodology, except her statements that, in her heart of hearts, she didn't know she was creating a marital loan and she didn't think she was. But the other part of it that's important is the problem with the defendant's argument is that it overlooks the other statements Ms. Charlson made. He only put in his brief the negative statements that she made. All the other statements, which, by the way, precede that, she relied on her expert's methodology. Examples, pages 343, 375, 352, 444, 577. And in fact, the trial court so found. What the judge found was that she was relying on her expert. And in fact, when you read the transcript, 356, 357, 377, finding of fact 25, the judge actually stopped the repeated questions because he said she said she's relying on her expert. She said she doesn't know the answer to that question. The fact that she didn't know how to trace the property and she relied on an expert does not mean that the expert isn't qualified. Remember,
But by the same token, that testimony of hers doesn't detract from her intent testimony. I read that as her saying, explaining why she can't explain the mechanics of tracing. And we all know that's very difficult sometimes. So as I read it, she was talking about the mechanics of tracing, not about whether she intended loans or... It seems pretty clear to me.
Exactly, Your Honor.
But isn't it absolutely clear and undisputed that she did not ever intend for there to be loans?
She didn't understand what a loan meant. Let's talk a minute about that loan provision. What does that loan provision say? In simple terms, here's what it says. We have separate property, we have marital property. If we use marital property to help my separate property, I have to pay the marital estate back. Who wouldn't agree to that? That's simply all that provision says. If you use some marital money to benefit one of the separate properties, whether it's his or hers, you pay it back. That's what the loan concept is. And the loan concept goes in with the commingling provisions. Because we all know, and especially after 20 years, people commingle things. They just forget that they're supposed to do something separate, and they commingle them. And the provisions then say, if you do that, it doesn't change the nature of it. It doesn't turn it into marital property. But if, again, you do that, here's a way that we can deal with it if you do it, if you mix up the two things. And by the way, the tracing is not a novel issue in South Dakota. This court has said in divorce cases, the relative contribution of the parties to the accumulation of an asset is to be considered. How do we do that? We trace it. We don't call it that, but that's what we do. And I think if we look at that marital loan provision, the reason that Mr. Charlson doesn't like it, of course, is because it supports Ms. Charlson's position regarding how to handle the funds going into that account. The PMA was to protect her separate property. That's what everybody said. And let's talk a minute about what Mr. Sabers pointed to in the document. He pointed to the provision at the beginning where he talks about where a separate property, where's marital property. So I think what's important to look at here is that in relying on that kind of language, and Justice Wilbur pointed it out, he ignores those first words, except as provided specifically above. Let's look at what's specifically above. Purpose and intent, to relinquish the right of each party that may or will arise by virtue of the marriage relationship as against the separate property of the other. And the separate property is defined not just the property they brought in. It's the gains, it's the proceeds, it's the changes. 2A says, the separate property shall be and remain sole and separate property of that party. Each party specifically relinquishes and disclaims any and all right, title, interest, and claim of every kind or nature regardless of the nature or source of that right, which will or may otherwise arise by virtue of the marriage. 2B, during lifetime, each party shall retain the sole and separate ownership and control of his or her separate property. 2D, each party is free to replace the assets. The replacement and proceeds of separate property shall be and remain separate property. Of course, these are the very clauses that caused them to have the commingling provisions as a protection in case they don't do that. And those clauses clarify that even if the money is commingled, it retains a separate status. And then paragraph 9 reinforces again, second time, that commingling cannot be construed as evidence of an intention, express or implied, or an agreement, actual or implied, to change the character of separate property. So what does paragraph 4 mean then? Paragraph 4 means that if marital money is used to buy property during the marriage, marital property, regardless of the title on it, it's going to be marital property. But it has to be marital money that's used. And marital money is not what's defined all above as separate property. Mr. Charlson's fixation with paragraph 7 does not override the other sections of the premarital agreement. And he talked about the any marital property, the purchase of any marital property as being part of that language. It says, and any acquisition of marital property. It does not say that every acquisition of property out of that account is marital property. It's only every acquisition of marital property. Marital property being defined as different than separate property. And one of the issues here is that the marital property is different between the two parties because Ms. Charlson brought in assets, Mr. Charlson did not. Everything she gets from those assets, including proceeds, income, is not marital. Everything he has is marital because he is not protected by the premarital agreement. That's one of the reasons for the disparity in the end as to what happens. The purpose of that premarital agreement, of course, was to protect her money that she had, her property that she had, and the growth of that property that she had during the time. If I may just a minute, Your Honor, I think there was one other part I wanted to, yes. The effect of the use of the funds in 7183, it's an interesting point. 7183 is not a marital bank account. It is an investment account. It's not a bank account at all. They had other bank accounts that they used to pay their utilities and their insurance and things like that. So if you want to be a purist about this, this is not a bank account. It's an investment account, stocks, bonds, invested. And who controlled that investment account? Who's it with? Edward Jones. Who works at Edward Jones? Mr. Charlson does. He knew what went in and out of that bank account. The parties used their other bank accounts to cover those ordinary living expenses. And just as a quick response to the allegation that my client didn't put in her fair share in the account, I draw the court's attention to Exhibit 26, which uses only the years the parties were actually living together. And the court will see that the contribution figures are 75.3% for Don, 70.3% for Angie. We have to remember that this document must be read as a single document. And the fact that the parties, Mr. Charlson doesn't like the outcome, does not mean that he didn't consent to it. The consent is in the formation of the contract. The marital loans are created by actions, not by consent. If this happens, the result is a marital loan. And so the consent was with the validity arguments. There was no arguments about that at the time, and therefore the parties are bound to that particular provision, as well as all the other provisions in this document.
All right. Ms. Viking, before
yes, sir.
I forget or you get away from it, Mr. Sabers talked about what your client's intent was. I don't recall reading the findings and the agreement, well, the findings. That Judge Day declared this agreement to be ambiguous. Did he find it ambiguous or not ambiguous? And I don't recall that as an argument in the briefs.
It was not, Your Honor. There was no argument that the language was ambiguous, excuse me. The parties just interpreted it differently
How do we even get to what testimony on intent is then? Do we?
I don't believe you do, Your Honor, because it has to be ambiguous first. And then if it's ambiguous, and we don't believe it's ambiguous, the court has said in cases that just because people have a different interpretation does not make it ambiguous. The court determines whether it's ambiguous or not. The court simply listened to the two views of the parties and determined that our position was the correct position. And if you read it, it's not ambiguous. It's clear what it says. And it's a mechanism to go along with the other provisions on commingling. Mr. Saber said, what a party wants in a divorce is different than what they wanted when they started the marriage, or in this case, signed the agreement. And that's clear in this case that is the disagreement, that our client is only asking for what was agreed to before. When you read the trial and the first validity, they talked about, in fact, this was his idea to have a prenuptial agreement. She'd gone through a divorce, lost property. He had gone through a divorce, was concerned that her property would be somehow used by his ex-wife. It was very clear what this was about. He had no assets. That's what he said. That's what the court found. So the only assets to protect were her assets. So knowing that this is the whole purpose that she had in this and that the parties agree this is the purpose, why would she ever then modify that or think she was modifying it by putting it into this marital account? She just thought that it meant it was her money, separate. She knew that. That's what they had agreed upon. It went in. She didn't understand that that would change the character. And by the way, the agreement says it will not change the character. And so when it came out, she considered it her separate property. The tracing of the 27,000 documents, that's what she provided. She provided the documentation, the data upon which the decision of the expert was made. That was her role. Her role was to provide that documentation, and she did. And they, by the way, whenever they couldn't do the kind of tracing that would really show that it was her money, they erred on the side of saying it's marital money. And then they used the provisions that said, what happens when you do that? There's a loan. So all of those things tie together to make clear that the court's decision was correct in this. The court listened for a long time, paid a lot of attention to this. We used electronic filing in this case. All the documents were on the computer that we were using because of the size of them. So the court naturally listened to that expert as part of the testimony. If you read the findings, the very long findings, you see that it's very specific how they did it. And their expert agreed with that, by the way. And their expert also said this on page 33. And this was a question being asked, a cross-examination question of their expert. Now, in your experience as a financial expert, is it common for parties to not understand the consequences of certain movement of funds and how that impacts a formal tracing? Yes, I would say it's very common. When we meet with parties doing tracing, they often don't realize that by certain actions and movements of their funds, that their separate or non-marital claims can be negatively impacted. That was our expert. Their expert testified that in asking, have you worked with clients who are not financially savvy? Yes. And have you worked with clients who do not have an understanding of financial issues? Yes. Have you worked with clients who don't understand contract terms? Yes. I mean, this is kind of much ado about nothing. The fact that she was upset and saw that her property was being taken and she didn't understand how this concept worked, but she understood the one important thing, and that is It was hers. They agreed it was hers. The growth was hers. The assets were hers. And that's what the premarital agreement was designed to protect. That's what Judge Day found. And we'd ask the court to affirm the decision of Judge Day.
So what's left after you get a decision on this case?
It will go back to the Minnesota court, and they will decide the division. This was an interpretation of, under South Dakota law, what is separate on marital property based upon the premarital agreement. That information then goes back to the Minnesota court. By the way, this has been pending since 2012. And they will decide what an equitable division is under Minnesota law. So this is just a segregation, basically, of the property. And in some cases, valuation, when we had to have separate sections. And I would also point out that one other thing that's probably important for the court to understand, because there's an argument about how unfair this seems to be. In the testimony, you will find that there is, and there's more than this, but there's at least $800,000 of other property that's marital property, agreed marital property, and will be divided by the parties in Minnesota. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
I have you going?
Okay.
Just to follow up to Justice Wilbur's question, I think I understand, but I don't want to mess up our decision so that it confuses things, but Judge Day then decided what the agreement meant, but was he deciding specific assets?
Yes, in the sense that he was determining whether they were marital or separate property. He didn't create assets. The parties had agreed basically on what the assets were. It was just a question of, were they marital, separate, or mixed?
And then that decision, once that decision of marital, separate, or mixed, that then goes back to the court in Minnesota to apply that under Minnesota law?
Yes, what they will do is they will take that, as I understand it, they will take that information and then they will apply, just like we would, you know, the age of the parties, the health of the parties, the relative the contribution will be taken care of in part of it at least, but there's the other parts of the marital property. They will take the criteria then to the facts, which these are the assets, these are the marital, these are the separate, and then they will decide how to divide those.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Who does the valuation?
Pardon me?
Which court does the valuation?
The valuation that has been done by Judge Day will be the valuation they use on those assets. Okay. There may be other assets that have to be valued by the court.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sabers, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Well, I didn't hear an answer to the question that was posed. When a contract says no waiver or relinquishment of separate property can be considered a relinquishment of marital property. So this contract contemplates that the parties will waive and relinquish rights to separate property. It discusses it. That's why there's the either separate property or earnings going to a joint marital bank account to acquire any marital property. But it says you can waive and relinquish rights to separate property. Does that conflict with the commingling? I still don't believe it does, Justice Severson, because she had 9 separate accounts available to her, separate accounts that she could have utilized to keep her assets separate. But this contract required her to waive or relinquish claims to some separate property and to earnings during the marriage, because that's how they're going to fund ordinary living expenses, and that's how they're going to acquire marital property that, again, is defined as any property shall be determined to be marital if it is acquired from and after the date of marriage. There is an absolute line in the sand that is written in this premarital agreement. That's why the word existing is used to define separate, and that is why this premarital agreement says marital property shall be any property acquired from and after the date of marriage. This contract contemplates a waiver of separate property because it says it. Because these people needed to live like married couples. They needed to pay their bills. And sure, married people are going to acquire marital property. And acquire marital property, they did. Intent. Understanding. You can't reconcile Ms. Charlson's understanding of this contract with what her experts said. And I've quoted you the specific verbatim statements, even made in the Appley's brief. Ms. Charlson doesn't interpret this contract the way her experts do. Ms. Carlson doesn't understand this contract the way her experts do. And it's more than...
Does it matter?
Yes, it matters.
Well, wait for my question. Did Judge Day find that the contract was ambiguous?
No, he did not.
So you look at the four corners of the document, what intent and what either party... I mean, we've heard probably 5-10 cases this week where people disagree on what the contract means.
Yep.
But we look at the four corners of the document as to what it means, not what the parties say they think.
It is a de novo review. Judge Day is not given...
And you're not contesting that.
What I'm saying is we believe that when it says the parties will relinquish and waive rights to separate property when they put it into a joint marital bank account to acquire marital property, that's what we're saying. We're saying that's not ambiguous. That gives these two parties, and by the way, that's what they understood. That's what they understood. Because if you look at the transcript at page 360, they say, Ms. Charlson, was it your intention that those funds that you just discussed that went towards marital expenses had a separate property interest? If there was money, you know what? This tracing methodology or whatever they call it or whatever methodology, that's a Minnesota thing we had to do. And so I have to rely on my experts. The two parties understood this contract the same way. The only party, and they're not a party, I'm sorry, I shouldn't call them a party. The only interpretation and understanding of this contract, the one that was adopted by Judge Day, is the Minnesota expert retained by Ms. Charlson. You can't put them together. The two parties say, that's a dog.
Yeah, but that interpretation is based on the contract.
That interpretation is based on what the two parties, when they entered into this contract, understood the contract to mean. Because you can't look anywhere else. If Ms. Charlson says, this is the way I understood it, and Mr. Charlson say, well, that's the way I understood it, then you can't go hire some expert in Minnesota to say, yeah, but this is what it really meant.
What if they're both wrong and the contract's clear?
Well, then you get into an estoppel and waiver argument, which was pled in the limited answer that I filed. Because you have two parties who lived together for 20 years with their understanding. That's how they lived. They acquired marital property. That's how they both testified they lived and worked. And if 20 years later, Ms. Charlson's going to say, well, I don't like it. I don't like my understanding and how we lived for 20 years. I don't like the interpretation that I have, so I'm going to go hire somebody else to tell me something else. You can't do that after 20 years. You can't go hire an expert to do that.
I understand that, but look, doesn't this just come down to the question whether we read the contract the same way the expert did?
Yes.
Okay.
What it comes down to is you have two parties who understood it one way, and you have an expert who understood it another. But this court can read the contract better than the Minnesota experts can read it. And again, it comes back to if a contract specifically addresses the issue that you can and will waive separate property interests during the marriage, it says it. It says you're going to waive or relinquish rights to separate property. And how are you going to do it? Well, when you live together for 20 years, you're both going to take your marital earnings, you're both going to take property, and you're going to put it into the joint marital bank account. And that's the other fallacy here. We argue mutual understanding. No one knew how the trial court was going to understand this case until the trial court made a decision basing, this is how I interpret the case. At that point, I would submit to this court that the interpretation of the trial court is not the interpretation of the parties or the parties' understanding. And so for the first time, I think it was brought to the attention that the court just adopted an interpretation that neither party agrees with. And that's why we say, listen, contract requires two parties to have agreed to the same thing at the same time.
We care what anybody thinks? The trial court, two parties, the expert. Don't we just read the document and say this is what it says?
I think you do need to take into account the way the parties understood the contract for 20 years. They understood.
Is this unambiguous?
Yeah.
Ms. Charlson did not testify that she understood or acted consistent with the way her experts interpreted this.
Appeal that the trial court was wrong in finding the contract unambiguous?
The trial court never, it wasn't an issue. Both of us have an interpretation that we believe is appropriate. I suppose this court, because you're reviewing the contract de novo, if you cannot reconcile the fact that the parties contemplated the waiver of separate interests to go into a joint marital bank account with the commingling or the separate, if you can't reconcile those because you got to give effect to every sentence in this contract, then it's ambiguous. This court can do that because it's a de novo review, as Chief Justice Gilbertson said. No, it doesn't matter what anybody said. It's ultimately up to this court. But if this court reads the sentence, waiving and releasing claims to separate property, okay, you can't, you can do that, and that's how you did it. You put it into the joint marital bank account. Well, how do you reconcile that with the commingle? Well, if you can't reconcile that and you're doing a de novo review, there has been nothing waived. Both parties believe they have the right reading. If you believe that both readings are reasonable or that, well, honestly, both parties agreed to the interpretation, it was the experts in Minnesota who didn't. The last issue I want to get to is, even if this court were to get to the point where it says, all right, we agree with Ms. Charlson's interpretation, then you have to look at the actual admission of the expert report and whether it had sufficient foundation for purposes of being admitted into evidence. And we would submit that even if you get there, the expert report of Ms. Charlson did not have adequate foundation and should have never been admitted. And why?
Well, wait a minute here. You're on a rebuttal, and she didn't get to argue this. I don't think this is proper.
It's all fair enough.
I think you're bringing up a new issue.
It is both in my appellant's brief. It is the third issue identified in my appellant's
brief.
You
can rest on that, though.
Yep, and then on the appellant's reply, it's also the third. The law in this state should not be that two parties who agree on what a contract means. They did. Read the transcript. It's hard when you have so many pages, but I tried to give you the transcript sites that have been provided. Ms. Charlson never read this contract to have a separate property interest in marital property. She didn't. Ms. Charlson never believed that they were doing loans. Look at paragraph 9 and how they define loans. The fact is, loans needed to be in writing. Unless there was going to be interest, and then they needed to put it in writing otherwise. Why did they never put it in writing? Because there were never any loans. She said there were no loans. He said there were no loans. How do you pay a loan that's payable on demand if it's not required to be in writing and if neither party knew it existed? That would be awfully difficult. And again, the parties had an understanding of this contract for 20 years. She went out and hired an expert in Minnesota to disagree with her interpretation and her understanding. And you shouldn't be allowed to do that. We would ask that you reverse and remand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Silvers.